Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 214, Deity Yoga, Buddhism and Theism.
The thing about deity yoga, I think I just thought of something different that is very useful. It's fun to work together, really. It's really enjoyable. I'm liking that. Let me see now. So people might wonder, well, wait a minute. We heard that Buddhism was non-theistic, like the Dalai Lama likes. So in India, they like to say, it's a sort of normal thing to say in India, that Buddhism and Jainism are the two non-theistic traditions, distinguishing Buddhism from the Western Islam and Christianity, and Judaism, all three of which exist in India in different forms, and also from Vaishnavism, Shaivism, and Shaktism, you could say, three types of theism, one about the goddess, Shaktism, and then Shiva and Vishnu, right? So then Buddhism is non-theistic, and I begged his holiness, I had a big argument with him. When he was invited once to visit Kuwait for a dialogue. And I said, Your Holiness, when you go to Kuwait, please don't announce that you're non-theistic, like you love to do. Please don't. Because when the Muslim hears, not, you know, one who's been around here, that's different, but someone in Kuwait, when they hear that, they think atheistic, and they think this and that, and then subliminally and subconsciously, you are decapitated instantly. So there's no more real dialogue in the sense that it shuts them off, you know, it's like they're not possible for them. And actually, what's non-theistic about Buddhism? Look, you're talking about deity yoga. Well, what's a deity? Why deity? Well, Buddha yoga, okay, we gotta understand that. Why deity yoga? So, and then I asked him, and then he said, well, what is this deity yoga, he said. What is this like? What kind of theism? And so you could say non-monotheistic. Although that would be bad because then they think you are polytheistic and then that's idolatry and so on. So I say, why don't you think of something like infinitheistic? Or some kind of, Ike suggested, I use that myself sometimes. Or, like meaning that you believe in the divine but in different forms and you don't believe in a creator. So you can say non-creator theistic or something, you know, you can try anything, but just don't say non-theistic. Because Buddhism is actually very theistic. And if you go to Pali Suttas, you know, which some sort of modern Buddhists who are trying to be very secular, they go like, well, we don't have those deities in Pali. But in fact, they do.
Sure.
When Buddha is born, Brahma and Indra, the two big gods of that time, king of the gods, Indra is like Zeus, and Brahma is like a, you know, some sort of more absolute level god, and they receive the baby, and they bathe him, and then they present him to the mom and so forth. They're like a bunch of midwives or something, except it's in easy. He just comes out like that. He has like a psychic cesarean out of the side. She doesn't have labor or anything like that. Maya Devi doesn't. So then when we say deity yoga, what do we mean? Well, the thumbnail of what Tantra is that I love still is Taratoku's thumbnail, which he says, because of continuity, it means the art of rebuilding the world out of wisdom. Once wisdom has destroyed the world built out of ignorance, which is the world of suffering, samsara. So wisdom of understanding reality as emptiness or selflessness or whatever it is, or nirvana, the non-duality of nirvana and samsara, that wisdom destroys the world of suffering, But then once you destroy that, then you have to rebuild something for those who didn't yet develop that wisdom. So you take the wisdom and you build out of the wisdom. You follow? That was a beautiful, I think that's the most beautiful thumbnail. Now, where deity gets into the picture is that since in the Buddhist culture, the idea of deities as being a kind of being, you know, like a human being, but sort of more powerful, more intelligent, living in a more pleasant circumstance, and therefore not as advantageous as a human to attain nirvana because they're more self, more indulged, tend to be more indulged and less paranoid than a human. A human is vulnerable and they know they're going to die soon, and so they're in a rush to like find something meaningful that they can deal with death about, you know. And whereas these kind of deities, and then Buddhists from the beginning, including in the Pali, there are six levels of heaven where different kinds of deities reside in the, what's called the desire realm heaven, which are just like anybody's notion of heaven, even Mark Twain's. Not that Mark Twain's notion of heaven, not quite, where he said nobody, the reason that Americans are such horrible sinners is that they don't want to go to heaven because it's so boring. It's like an internal church social in little frocks and sitting around, and much rather there's no gambling, there's no liquor, no dancing. It's just like sitting around in little frocks. Mark Twain said, that's why Americans are such sinners, because they're too boring to go to heaven. And so they don't have any heaven like that. Actually, the Indian heavens are very pleasurable. There's a lot of gods and goddesses and a lot of parties. And but they're more powerful. So in the idea that with wisdom you so I'm just trying to make these two things meet. Mm-hmm. The idea that with wisdom you rebuild a world, well, in a way you assume the responsibility and the role of what someone imagines a deity has of shaping the world. Because the inside of emptiness, as I've told you all tirelessly or maybe tiresomely, I don't know, one or the other, that emptiness doesn't give you license to think that nothing exists. What emptiness does is it makes you realize that things, everything, the way you perceive it as existing is in some sense your construction. So emptiness re-empowers language and imagination in an enormous manner, because it makes you realize that when you see what you think of as the ordinary world, you're actually imagining it with a routinized imagination that culture and language are giving you of how you're supposed to imagine it. You know, like you see someone, oh, that's a human being, oh, that's a woman, oh, that's a sentient being, oh, that person is alive. You bang, all these concepts come jumping out, and they jump out, that's a picture, that's a wall, this is the color white, that's a light. And those are all concepts. But and we think that when we see a wall, that the wall kind of expresses itself to us as a wall, but actually we shape our perception of it with our routinized imagination. When you realize emptiness, or what to whatever degree, it weakens the seeming inevitability of that routinization. That is to say, you eventually get to where you realize, oh, I see a pillar because I have a concept of a pillar, because of this and that, so actually I shape whatever inconceivable process of neurons, you know, photons, you know, whatever the energetic process is of perception of light reflecting over something and then knowing that that's a concrete pillar with rebar inside, that it's supporting a building, you know, with huge amount of compression strength and all this. You know, all of that is just loaded into it by my imagination. But what we, you know, therefore I have an image of a pillar, you know, imagination. I make a image. I put my image over that, and then I recognize it, and then I feel I have it under control. I know what it is. So as you realize emptiness, more and more that you realize it, you realize that it isn't necessarily that. And it's you're shaping. Of course, you're not shaping in a vacuum. It's not solipsism, Western thought, where it's all just in your mind. It's in all lots of other people's minds, too. So the world is the intersection of many beings' minds. And among those beings, the more powerful ones are the gods. And they're all these different levels. And the lower ones are less powerful than the upper ones, and so forth. So deity yoga. Now, among deity yoga, the Buddha forms are mostly not form realm deities. They're desire realm deities. Mm-hmm. So they're a little more humanoid type of deities, and yet it's a kind of image of yourself as a Buddha in a heavenly plane. And like some of the great bodhisattvas, like Manjushri, Avalokiteshvara, sometimes you can call them celestial bodhisattvas. They live in Buddha lands, and they have these different kinds of bodies. Actually, they're not in what John Perry Barlow calls meat space. So then the distinctive thing of the creation stage that you're saying is where the components of deity yoga are, that once you realize that your identity of your ordinary self, my Bob Thurman identity, as an ordinary human being, flesh and blood, stuck in a certain world with a certain lifespan, all kind of identifiable characteristics, that is eroded by the critical insight, vipassana, that looks through things to see what's really objectively real and what is imposed by concept. And I realize that ordinary identity is a complete construction. Then I am free to reconstruct my identity. And the reason, and then the Tantra comes in and offers itself to you to help you do this systematically and consciously with the art. It gives you like the art manual of how to do that. And particularly presenting itself as, it's not only, one thing that's very clear, it's not an alternative to the Mahayana Bodhisattva path to Buddhahood. It's not an alternative path. It's not like, the ordinary people, they get to be bodhisattvas and they take three incalculable aeons to achieve Buddhahood, and some special people get Tantra and they can do it in a weekend or in a year or in a life. No, every bodhisattva has access to the Tantra, and it eventually comes to any bodhisattva when they reach a certain stage of energy in their path, and they get impatient. And they don't get impatient because they're unwilling to stay in the world for three incalculable aeons of lifetime, but because they're impatient to have the power to help others sooner, because they see others suffering endlessly, and therefore they can't bear that, so they want to do this quicker. So then the Tantra offers itself to them. Once they have a level of detachment, renunciative detachment, like you were taught in the Hinayana, once they have a level of commitment to the fate of other beings, which is the Bodhisattvayana, the Bodhicitta, you know, the mind of altruism that wants to save other beings from suffering. And then once they have an initial understanding of emptiness, that if this is all relative and it's all mutable, therefore, and it's not objectively fixed in meat space the way it is. And then Tantra is where you then drop those concepts, and you can't do it, therefore, until you've had some understanding of emptiness. That's why it's esoteric for people who don't. You can understand that someone who had the naive realist notion of I'm the absolute Bob Thurman, and I have an absolute identity, and that's me, and that's really me, that's the real thing around here, is my identity. You know, like, what do they call it, a narcissist? There's another term for a particularly pernicious type of malignant narcissist. Malignant narcissist. If you take a malignant narcissist and you say, you can do Tantra, and now you're Guhya Samaja, or you're Tara, or you're Manjushri, or you're Guhya, or you're Hevajra, and then they'll become megalomaniacs. That's a prescription for megalomania. Only when the person has some idea that whatever identity I have and whatever I think I am is in some sense a construction, and I'm not really quite sure what it is, and acknowledging that I don't really know what I am, and then one is, and then acknowledging that when I feel like a certain thing, it's because I'm constructing that. You know, I'm responsible for how I feel, because I'm a work in progress. I shape my sense of identity. So once one realizes that, then, there's a strategy of shaping your identity into a pure identity, into a Buddha identity, into a divine identity. Mm-hmm. You know, for certain practices. While, you know, gold vehicle still means it's a vehicle. So again, it would be another wrong thing to think that Tantra means you automatically project it into Buddhahood just by, just like in Zen, you know, they say you just sit and you're Buddha. In Soto Zen, you know, in Zhao Tung tradition of Zen. And that's a koan, is that you're just by sitting, you're Buddha, and yet you feel like you feel hungover and you feel like you have a sore butt, but yet you're a Buddha. And so that doesn't make you a Buddha just because you went and sat in a zendo. It means that you're sort of putting the pressure on yourself that Buddha thinks you're a Buddha, maybe, or you could be a Buddha, And then you're dealing with it, the discrepancy between how you feel and what you're supposed to be, your deepest, highest possible self. And then that's a powerful form of goal vehicle.
Yeah.
It's an unarticulated, as esoteric, kind of tantra, actually. Zen is a kind of tantra, in fact.
Aloha, greetings, and salutations, podcast wallas. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. This two-part episode was originally recorded at Tibet House's Force for Good class series held annually in New York City at Tibet House US and online. This session was with Professor Thurman and Dr. Tom Yarnell of Columbia University. In the full version of this teaching, they dive deeply into the fine art of Tibetan guided meditation, focusing on deity yoga, creation, and generation stage tantra. If you're inspired to learn more about these practices, please look in the podcast description for the video link to the full Force for Good class. The Force for Good class series is inspired by the work of His Holiness the Dalai Lama and the book by Daniel Goleman by the same name. The Force for Good class series brings together some of the greatest minds and hearts of the Buddhist world to discuss how Buddhist philosophy and Buddhism in general is a force for good in our society. To learn more about these ongoing classes starting in September 2019 at Tibet House US, please visit their website at tibethouse.us. The Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House US membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, please visit tibethouse.us. Membership includes discounts on special programs at Tibet House US, Menlo Retreat, and extra special Dosset tours led by Professor Thurman and geographic expedition to Buddhist pilgrimage sites around the world. Trips in 2019 include Bhutan. Your online participation and monthly support helps make Tibet House's mission to present and preserve Tibetan culture possible. With your help, we can make a difference. Interstitial music for the Bob Thurman Podcast is generously supplied by our dear friend Tenzin Chogyal. To learn more about the work and music of Tenzin Chogyal, please visit his website at tenzinchogyal.com. And now back to the second half of this week's episode, which includes a reading of the poem Lichen by Lou Welsh by our poet laureate Gary Gock.
The initiant imagines going into this palace, and this powder thing is made really in a beautiful manner where the monks are chanting. And they're going through a certain description of the three-dimensional universe with the palace in the center. And they're visualizing a big, huge mandala that they're all in while they're doing it. And then they imaginatively draw the foundation lines and the gateways and the ornaments and everything, they pull them down from the space of the hologram that they're visualizing and embed them in the geometry of this two-dimensional mandala, and then they put in the colors, which are the symbols of the wisdom, and various offerings and ornaments and things. It's really beautiful and extraordinary. And this is typical Tibetan. In India, in the ancient times, the guru, for such an initiation, would usually make this with his fingers using flower petals, a kind of bigger thing like that, that the person actually could walk inside. It would still be two-dimensional, but they'd be visualizing together this kind of thing, and then the guru would lead them inside and so forth, and they'd walk around inside the building. But here, they then make it with this tiny powdered color, and you couldn't possibly walk on it. In fact, when they make it, they wear a bandana, so they won't breathe on it, because it's very fine, like talcum powder, and it would blow away, it would be a mess. So then it creates this incredibly vivid impression. So that's the deity you think you are, both male and female. It's sometimes just the male, or sometimes just the female. But usually both of them. You are that being, with six arms. Each body has six arms and three faces. That's a female yogini, one of the 84 Mahasiddhas, but I forget which one. Anyway, this is the chakra system. This is what I just wanted to talk about, because this underlies the creation stage. A lot of people in Tibet, actually, and here in America today, they don't like this business of this complicated mandala. I told you the story last time about the lady who was attending our summer school once of our Institute of Buddhist Studies in Massachusetts, who had received the Kala Chakra initiation in Wisconsin, the first one given in North America. And she just dropped into the class, you know, where we were going to see, how do you practice this? How do you visualize this? You know. And then it was all these complicated things, and suddenly about 15 minutes into the class, there was this outraged or shocked or frightened exclamation, like, what? We have to do all these complicated things? But I thought we already got the initiation. So she thought you just got initiated and then you were Buddha or something. You know, when you get instruction in how to do Guhya Samaja, you go to art class. And you make architectural drawings of a building so you can visualize it. And you know, draw the door ornaments, and you draw the eaves, things hanging from the eaves, the jewels and the yak tails and the little bells that hang on the eaves of the building, and the ornaments, jewel ornaments across the top of the deck and everything. And you do all of that sort of things. So therefore, when you're doing the creation stage, you're in a universe where you're in a palace. You are a bunch of beings in the palace, not just the one being. You're a whole community of beings, actually, because you are all the other beings in there. That's why it's called the esoteric community, the deity is. And you have to know what each one holds in the hand, and what their fingernails are like, and what their shoulders feel like, and all these complicated things. You have to imagine that, where you actually will feel that, you see. So in the perfection stage, then, you start going up and down this central channel. You see this picture? That's the central channel. And those are five chakras on the central channel: brain, throat, heart, navel, and genital. And your sort of subtle mind goes up and down that central channel, which you open. And then you open up to go a little further. And you visualize yourself like that with this thing, and it goes down to the genital area, not just to the navel. But then she's just showing it. That picture just shows like that. I already showed you these things, I think. Where's that? I'm looking for the other one. This one. So you see here where you have the central channel. That's the brain up in the top, and each one has a loop of a white and red channel that are left and right, but they're looped around the central channel. And this shows as if they're just loosely looped, but actually they're tied taut. So the central channel is knotted off in the neuroscientific way of visualizing, of actually how it is for ordinary being. And the heart one in particular, you see all those loops. There's three loops of the red and three loops of the white. So it's a six-fold knot, it's called. And that is what keeps you alive, actually. It holds your subtle, super subtle mind, your clear light mind, in the heart chakra center, which is your vital principle, actually. And if it were to open, and it will open for everyone when you die, it will wrench itself open just like that. And the yogis are trying to open it without dying when they are able to identify themselves as being such a subtle mind and being then in an open space like that and being able to either be out of body or in body, move back and forth without letting the body go and without dropping dead, actually, leaving the body in a kind of trance state, like a hibernating trance state, without normal respiration, in fact, actually. It's this advanced, you know. They're not one of the signs that you really entered your energies into the central channel from the right and left channels is that there's no ordinary coarse breathing. And you're sort of like a frog. There are certain frogs that take in oxygen through the skin, and they don't necessarily, they can go underwater a long time. They don't, or fish have gills, right? And they get out of the water. So they don't inhale it like we do. And so it's very, very advanced neurological thing, is what I'm trying to say. I'm not getting into sort of technique. And this kind of thing is what is happening in the perfection stage, which is parallel with the great perfection, what the great perfection really is, or the great seal. That's stuff of the perfection stage. Now they say, therefore, that an ordinary person, if they try to leap into those levels of experience, without first having opened up the central nervous system neurologically, they're in great danger. But in a way, if they're trying to attain Buddhahood and they have the Bodhisattva vow, this and that, it's only danger that they might not make progress in this body. They might leave the body. You know, in the near-death experiences, some of you here for a Buddhist thing, maybe you've read some of those books, like Life After Life, or, you know, the famous one, Kenneth Ring, or all the near-death experience things. There's a bunch of them, you know, Embraced by the Light. Once it became a bestseller, there are lots of them, actually. And then Eben Alexander, what, that one where he went to heaven, the neuroscience guy, who the Harvard people wanted to burn at the stake because he was a neuroscientist. And we said there's a brain experience. You can have mental experience when the brain is not operating, which is a heresy, right, for the current materialists. So there's a lot of those things. But you realize one thing about them is when they do die, those people, the near-death people, or they're in the process of dying, and the ones who come back to tell the tale obviously don't finally die. They're just going down the tunnel, going into the light. You know, they have that kind of experience. There's many versions of that you can read up on. And then they don't want to come back. Often it's because they had a terrible accident or something, and their body's on some operating table, and they're being pieced together by a bunch of surgeons. And they're like, oh, in the light, oh, I'm out of that scene. No, I don't want to go back there. And then, so, you know, Jesus or Buddha or some Bodhisattva or the old wise shaman or the shamaness, whoever their guide is, comes and says, boop, nope, not your time. You have to go back. Right? You know, that's a common thing in the near-death experience. And then wham, they're back in their body, you know, all messed up. Although then they say, you know, this guy, Pierre Van Lommel, did you ever hear of his writing? He's a heart surgeon who got interested in it when he had some accounts of patients who did die on his table, clinically, but were revived, but then were not damaged when they revived. In fact, they were almost enlightened. They were loving. They were like completely changed personalities. And he started interviewing them, and he has a whole bunch of cases of how it transformed them. And he became very, very interested in that. He was a Dutch heart surgeon who worked at the hospitals in England for a long time. And he wrote a bunch of books since then. And so my point is, if you imagine yourself, visualizing yourself as Hevajra, or not just Guhya Samaja, who only has three arms on each side, but like one of these deities that has like 12 arms or 16 arms on each side, or some very complicated bunch of joints coming out of the chest and all this. If you develop that as a systematic shamatha meditation, as Tom said, where you're developing stability, one point of stability about yourself as having a different physical apparatus, and then a different mental self of identity, feeling of self-confidence, a feeling of like divinity would make you feel, it's basically a kind of super self-confidence, and even also kind of pressure of responsibility because you can shape your world type of thing, in other words. Because like being a Buddha, it's like a kind of being a king of Dharma, as they say. I think it's another reason in India that the Tantra was kept secret for a long time, from Buddha's time, for about 1,000 years, no publication and really top secret. Just like Mahayana for about 500, the exoteric Mahayana was kept secret. And then for another 500, the Tantra was kept secret. So for both of them were, the esoteric one was kept secret for a very, very small number of people. Because the initiation ceremony is like a royal coronation ceremony. The only people who were using those terminologies and doing that sort of thing were kings. And Brahmin priests were, you know, dumping oil, anointing. The word for initiation in Sanskrit is abhisheka, which means anointment. So it's like a royal coronation ceremony. I think the kings didn't appreciate a bunch of funky-looking yogis out in some charnel ground going around having royal consecration ceremonies on themselves, on each other. You know, I think they wouldn't have liked that in those earlier times, you know. It was only when India had built up this huge tolerance and relative nonviolence after 1,000 years of the Buddhist germ, you could say, opening up the people's like nervous system and understanding and tolerance and so on, that you could begin to have publications and, you know, texts even about Tantra. So therefore, when you do visualize this complicated thing and you feel like, okay, I have all these arms, then this has loosened the heart knot, loosened the throat knot, loosened the brain knot, and you'll be able to really get some energy into the central channel. And you're, so it's not going to be such a wrench of suddenly leaping into the void with like a tangled parachute, something like that. You know, if your parachute is all tangled and you jump out of the plane, you're going to pull lots of ripcords, and I don't know what's going to happen to you, you know. Maybe by luck, you know, it'll all unravel and the chute will open and you'll be fine. And maybe not. And then really it's a bad scene, you know. So the leaping, so that he deals with it. That's one of the central things in these two chapters that Dzogchenpa deals with, is why it is essential to develop this kind of artistic imagination. You know, some people say, oh, you know, I don't visualize well, I'm not an artist, I can't hold an image in my mind very long, etc. Well, of course not. Because if you don't have, if you don't have the prerequisite slippage of rigid self-identity and rigid confidence in your concretized perceptions of things, as if your reading of the wall comes from the wall, rather than it's your own investment. You know, the wall is there too, and other people see it. And, you know, cosmic rays don't see it, they go right through it, but other people do. And so it's more complicated than just it's objectively existent. One of the synonyms of emptiness is objectively unreal. You know, it has a certain kind of reality, but it, as an object thing in itself, it has an unreality instead, actually. That's what emptiness means. The mind becomes like the imaginative mind becomes like a microscope, where you can perceive something very, very tiny, like the size of a mustard seed, but you can see every detail of a deity with four faces and 12 arms, and in union with the consort, etc., as in the size of a mustard seed in the center of your heart, for example, and hold that very, very stably. They get into things like that. And here's the Kala Chakra with the 10 deities in the, okay. So anyway, I just wanted to give you an idea of the art, how you would learn to do this where you're not jumping into your central nervous system right away, but you're actually re-envisioning the external body instead, and you're, in re-envisioning the external body, you are, in a way, loosening and experimenting with the inner opening of the central nervous system in a gentle manner by visualizing the external thing in a certain way. Because, you know, we know from phantom limb phenomena, I mentioned this before, but I'll mention it again, we know from that sort of phantom limb phenomena and other kinds of things, that now, when I move this arm, in a way, I'm transmitting the impulse from my thoughts to do so through a model of myself as having this arm that's in my brain somewhere. And so the creation stage meditation is I'm altering that model in a temporary meditative state that I move back and forth into. I won't get trapped in that state because I know about emptiness. So any state I make is just itself another construct of emptiness. And then coming back to my ordinary meat space, Bob Thurman embodiment, my ordinary embodiment, I'm also coming back to the other image, which my brain is routinized and used to holding. So, although if I get really advanced, then it gets maybe a little, you know, it's rather bored to come back into meat space. It gets a little boring, and so maybe I'm less interested in doing so. But you have that flexibility, and it is that deep, the whole thing. It is very, very deep, therefore a little dangerous, actually. That's why they say if you enter Tantra before having the requisite preparation, it's dangerous. They say that. And that's why we're seeing now, just final thing, I'm sorry, on an ethical thing, that's why we're seeing now in some of these Tibetan groups, some of these poor gurus, I feel sorry for them, these lamas who are the big gurus, they get in trouble because they've been abusing their students a little bit. Because they're reading these things about, oh yeah, when you're really advancing, then there's no impurity, you know, everything is perfect, and things that normally would seem wrong are fine. But that's because both student and professor have reached a different stage. That doesn't mean you can go behave like that with all people, ordinary people. Then you're just being unethical and harming them, actually. First of all, deceiving them that just by some attending some ritual before they even understand emptiness, or they understand even the Bodhisattva mind, even in the West, they understand multiple lives, which is an automatic part of the Buddhist world, or the fact of the presence of different kinds of non-creator deities, but nevertheless deities. When they don't have, they're not in that kind of a cosmos, to then act like, oh yeah, because they're my student, and they came to some ceremony we did, then now I'm going to treat them like tantric adept disciples. And then it becomes abuse, because they're not really prepared for it. And the guy who does it obviously is not prepared to teach it, actually, unfortunately, really. Even though they might be somewhat extraordinary, they're just it's being misgrafted into another cultural universe where it totally doesn't fit. Mm-hmm. That's why when Dalai Lama gives a big mass initiation, like the Kala Chakra, he teaches 3 days of Shantideva, compassion, wisdom, ethics, you know, patience, tolerance, generosity, morality, and everything. And then he goes, at the end of the 3 days, before going into the ceremony and the initiation, he goes, nya, nya, I tricked you. You only came for the initiation because that's what you want. Even to the Tibetans, he says. But you probably really can't use it. You're not really ready for it. But you can be there as a blessing. It's in a future life, maybe, or another time. I'm not really able to transmit it, even. Which I don't believe, actually, anymore. But when he was younger, maybe that was true. So I'm not suitable to transmit it. You're not suitable to receive it. We're all doing it as a good omen and a blessing. But the real great thing was the preparatory teaching I gave you, and that's what you really need. And that's what you can really use. He always does that. Because he puts it in the right context. He's so honest. And he's not using it as some dominating little strategy of creating a cult for himself. You understand? I mean, the Tibetans, it already is, it's the cult of Tibetan culture. But so that's okay in a way. But even them, he scolds them. He's like, you can't really do this. You can just behave yourself, you know. And don't turn Om Mani Pay Me Hum into Om Money Pay Me Hum, which is the danger for you guys. See, who scolds the Tibetans like that? If they know English. Om Mani Pay Me Hum, Om Money Pay Me Hum. That's the danger for them.
I'm Gary Gok, and this poem is by Lew Welch. This one he wrote in the mid-60s, and I'll preface by saying it could be the anthem of the Sixth Extinction Rebellion. Springtime in the Rockies, Lichen, by Lew Welch. All these years I overlooked them in the racket of the rest, this symbiotic splash of plant and fungus feeding on rock, on sun, a little moisture, air, tiny acid factories dissolving salt from living rocks and eating them. Here they are, blooming. Trail rock, talus and scree, all dusted with it. Rust, ivory, brilliant yellow-green, and cliffs-like murals. Huge panels streaked and patched quietly with shooting stars and lupine at the base. Closer, with the glass, a city of cups, clumps of mushrooms, and where do the plants begin? Why are they doing this? In this big sky, and all around me, peaks and melting glaciers, why am I made to kneel and peer at tiny? These are the stamps on the final envelope. How can the poisons reach them? In such thin air, how can they care for the loss of a million breaths? What possibly could make their ground more bare? Let it all die. The hushed globe will wait and wait for what is now so small and slow to open it again. As now, indeed, it opens it again, this scentless velvet, crumbler of the rocks, this lichen. I'm Gary Gock, and this poetry segment is a part of the Bob Thurman podcast and is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives license. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal. And if you like, I'll give it a take too. Such a strange poem. Lichen, L-I-C-H-E-N, lichen. I guess I should explain that too. Welcome to the Bob Thurman podcast. I'm Gary Gock. I'm Gary Gock, and this poetry segment is a part of the Bob Thurman podcast and is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa, under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives license. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal. Continuing from my last poetry segment, I'm reading a poem by Lou Welch entitled Springtime in the Rockies. Lichen. Lichen is spelled L-I-C-H-E-N. You know, it's like that little moss you see on boulders. Springtime in the Rockies was a 1962 Technicolor musical with Betty Grable, but that's neither here nor there. Lou Welch was a beat along with Gary Snyder and Philip Whalen. Actually, they were roommates together at Reed College. And in 1965, in the mid-60s, he said something very pertinent, relevant, and I think nourishing for today. In the mid-60s, he said, "There's just too much bad news coming out about the planet. It's more than anybody can understand or contain in their mind. Rather than say no, do yes." So, in honor of the 6th Extinction Rebellion, I'll read this poem he wrote in the mid-60s about the Rockies, where he hiked in and never came out. Springtime in the Rockies, lichen. All these years, I overlooked them in the racket of the rest. This symbiotic splash of plant and fungus feeding on rock, on sun, a little moisture, air. Tiny acid factories dissolving salt from living rocks and eating them. Here they are, blooming. Trail rock, talus, and scree, all dusted with it. Rust, ivory, brilliant yellow-green, and cliffs like murals. Huge panels streaked and patched quietly with shooting stars and lupine at the base. Closer with the glass, a city of cups, clumps of mushrooms, and where do the plants begin? Why are they doing this? In this big sky, and all around me, peaks and the melting glaciers, why am I made to kneel and peer at tiny? These are the stamps on the final envelope. How can the poisons reach them? In such thin air, how can they care for the loss of a million breaths? What possibly could make their ground more bare? Let it all die. The hushed globe will wait and wait for what is now so small and slow to open it again. As now, indeed, it opens it again, this scentless velvet, crumbler of the rocks, this lichen. I'm Gary Gough, and this poetry segment is a part of the Bob Thurman podcast and is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal.